Good afternoon, I suppose. I'm going to speak with you a little bit about an investigation that we did recently in the Houston Department of Health and Human Services for a potential mass rabies exposure. I have no personal financial relationships with commercial interests that are relevant to this presentation during the past 12 months. I'm going to go through a brief review of rabies, move into a discussion of the investigation, and then close with a few lessons learned from this situation. So just in terms of our refresher, for those who are not working with it on a regular basis, rabies is mainly a zoonotic disease. Its major reservoirs would be raccoons, skunks, foxes, coyotes, and in the case of Houston, what we're concerned mainly with is bats. It's transmitted when saliva or brain tissue from an infected animal comes in contact with mucous membrane or broken skin. The incubation period is generally 3 to 8 weeks. There is no screening test for exposure, which makes things very interesting. And once symptoms develop, rabies is nearly always fatal. What we do, because there's no screening test and there is no treatment once symptoms developed, is your main course would be post-exposure prophylaxis, what we refer to as PEP. PEP consists of 5 doses of the rabies vaccine given over approximately a month time frame, as well as 1 dose that would be weight dependent of human rabies immunoglobulin. There are some standard definitions for rabies exposure. The first would be a bite exposure. That would be an animal bite that breaks the skin and introduces saliva into the wound. Or a non-bite exposure, which is exposure of broken skin or mucous membranes to the saliva or brain tissue of an infected animal. And then we have a series of special categories for bat exposures. The first of the bat exposure specific exposure categories is a bite or scratch from a bat. That's obviously going to be your highest concern. We then have waking to find a bat in the room with a person, finding a bat in the room with a previously unattended infant or toddler, as well as finding a bat in a room with a mentally challenged or intoxicated person. And these last three mainly refer to situations where the person whose exposure you're concerned about isn't able to describe possible interactions or contact that may have occurred between the person and the bat that you found. So if we go through and talk about, moved my notes ahead too far. If we go ahead and talk into discussing the event, the initial notification occurred on Thursday, September 13th. Our department received a referral from our partners at the State Health Services Regional Office, which also happens to be located in Houston. The vet over at the regional office said they had received a call from a parent of a local university student regarding bats flying around in the dormitory. This is obviously a bit of a concern for us. So what we went ahead and did and confirmed the referral and initiated contact with the university. We spoke with the parent directly and found out that the parent said, yes, indeed, there is numerous bats that have been flying around in the dormitory. This has been going on for several days. They weren't pleased with the way the university was responding. And, oh, by the way, we've contacted the media. They have interviewed us, and it's going to be on the news tonight, which is always fun. So from the Human Rabies Prevention article that came out back in 1999, post-exposure prophylaxis is a medical urgency but not a medical emergency, but decisions must not be delayed. What this means is that we do need to plan a response plan. We need to plan it fairly quickly, but we have a little bit of time in planning our response plan, so that gives us the opportunity to plan a smart plan as opposed to just an immediate, oh my goodness, it's rabies reaction. So in terms of planning the response, as I said, we had a little bit of time. So we conducted some key informant interviews. Let me move that out of the way for you. That would be the reporting parent, student of the parent, as well as university staff. And again, as I said, we did confirm there was a colony of bats that seemed to be housed in the dormitory. They had recently shown up. They had been seen exiting the outside of the dormitory, and they had recently shown up inside the dormitory in the student rooms as well as in the corridors. So we do know that we have something to be a little bit concerned about. We reviewed an online video that's posted by the students, which I'll talk a little bit about later. We confirmed that the immediate threat was neutralized. We spoke with the university, and they agreed to relocate 211 students, which would be the dorm population, to area hotels. We identified and alerted our participating agencies, people that may be involved in the response. So that's going to include our local EPI group and the Houston Health Department. Our animal control group, those would be the folks that if there were any need to pick up bats, they would be responsible for that aspect of it. Our laboratory, because if we were submitting bats for testing, They would need to know that we may submit a larger number of bats than normal for testing. Our regional zoonoses programs, those are the folks that gave us the initial referral, as well as their partners over at the Central Office for the State Health Department. Those two agencies would be the ones responsible for providing the vaccine for anybody that was deemed needed post-exposure prophylaxis. And then finally, obviously, we contacted the university staff. So we were working with the Department of Housing, the Dean of Students, as well as the on-campus medical staff. So we alerted everybody to let them know that was going on, and we had a number of questions to talk about when we were planning our response. And one of the immediate questions that we really needed to talk about was how to define exposure. It seems fairly straightforward, but there's limited information on previous mass exposure scenarios. And what we did find was that most situations, they went ahead and did a mass prophylaxis campaign. So they vaccinated, 50 to 100 to 150 people, and we weren't really sure that that was going to be the appropriate response in this situation. So what we ultimately came up with for our definition of exposure for this specific response was a bite or scratch from a bat, which is going to be our highest concern exposure category, and that's part of the standard definition. Waking to find a bat in a room, which is again part of the standard definition and is a slightly higher concern. And then a lower concern, but something that we really didn't think that we could eliminate, was participation in behaviors similar to those seen on the YouTube video, including those observing but not actively participating. This references the online video that I mentioned earlier. What you can see down here in the bottom of the slide is just a quick screen capture from the video. It was videos of students had taken with their cell phones, and it clearly showed a number of bats flying around in the corridor. And the students had decided they wanted to take matters into their own hands and were looking at doing their own extermination policy. That involved, we have a young man standing there with a broom, as well as a young man standing there with a wet floor sign and a number of other implements. And what they were doing in a group setting was trying to swat down the bats. So the exposure in that scenario was probably limited and fairly low risk, but as you watch the video, it's a little bit chaotic. You can't be totally sure of what's going on, so we didn't feel comfortable excluding those activities from our exposure definition. So once we had our exposure definition defined, we could go ahead and move forward with developing the rest of our response plan. We focused on developing an informational briefing for the university students and staff. That was going to include a canned presentation, as well as a question and answer session, and provide the opportunity to conduct individual risk assessments for students or staff who felt that they may have been exposed. We also developed a plan for providing post-exposure prophylaxis for anybody that did meet the exposure definition. The vaccine for that would be provided by our Department of State Health Services, our State Department, and would be administered through the on-campus medical clinic, using their on-campus medical clinic staff as well as some contract nurses that they hired. And then finally, our department was going to be available for additional consults for any other concerns that came up, any other needs that came through. So we felt pretty comfortable going into the weekend that we had a good plan developed. Monday morning, as before we were getting ready to have our final coordination meeting with everybody involved, We had an unexpected interject. Again, always fun to get. Monday morning, we got a call from our laboratory that they had received specimens for testing for a suspected human rabies death. The deceased, we found out, was a college-aged female. Now, the timing wasn't quite right for this death to be associated with our investigation. There's a standard about 3 to 8 weeks of incubation period. So it was unlikely that she was involved in this immediate exposure, but what we were concerned about was, did this raise the possibility that there were other exposures associated with this event that we hadn't yet become aware of? So we did some initial investigation into this particular young woman. Like I said, she was college age, but we were not able to link her to the university. She wasn't attending any university. She lived in a completely separate part of town, and Houston's a very large area, so there's quite a bit of geographic distance between them. We weren't able to tie her in to any of our students. So we felt comfortable about that, and then later that afternoon, the tissue samples did come back negative, so indeed, she was not a human rabies death, so it's a little bit of excitement. Luckily, it didn't pan out in a negative way for us. If we moved ahead with implementing the response, again, we had a mandatory town hall meeting that session for, or that evening for students and staff that Monday evening. As I said, it had a joint information session between ourselves, our staff, as well as the state regional office staff, a group question and answer session, and finally, after all of that went on, the opportunity for students or staff to come and receive individual assessments, either by our staff or by some of the folks from the regional office. At that time, 15 students ended up stepping forward and saying they were concerned about what had gone on and they wanted to get an individual assessment. 11 of those students met the exposure definition and 4 did not. I was available and my staff were available for additional consults. What we did during those exposure assessments was in addition to asking them about their exposures, we were asking them about friends or colleagues, other dorm residents that they may have known who may have also been involved. So if a student said, I found a bat in my room, then we would go ahead and was your roommate home at the time? Who is your roommate? Let's find out if we've talked to your roommate. Essentially contact tracing in a way. So over that, as well as students who later, you know, maybe weren't comfortable stepping forward at that first, they contacted us at a later date. So over the course of about a week, we ended up conducting assessments on 24 students. Of those 24, 18 met the exposure definition, and all 18 did agree to receive prophylaxis. We obviously can't force prophylaxis on anybody. That's an individual decision. 6 of our students did not meet the exposure definition. 5 of those felt comfortable with that, and as we said, we didn't feel that they were at risk and did not receive prophylaxis. One student was very insistent that he was at risk. So again, we counseled him that we didn't feel that he needed prophylaxis, but if he wanted to coordinate with the university staff directly, that he was free to do so. And he did indeed make those arrangements with the university staff and did indeed receive prophylaxis. So in total, we had 19 students who received post-exposure prophylaxis. If we look at our exposure categories, 3 of those students did wake up to find a bat in the room with them. 18 of those 19, so this includes those 3, participated in or observed activities similar to those on the YouTube video. And then we had our one student who did not meet any of our exposure categories. And of those 19, we had two students, who experienced mild adverse events after administration of the HRIG and the first vaccine dose. We didn't have any additional adverse events that were reported to us. The university contracted with the pest control agency and successfully excluded the bats from the dormitory. And the students were ultimately returned to their rooms approximately 2 weeks after this all began. So we had a successful resolution to our investigation. And if we talk about the lessons learned, there are a few key points here that I think really made the investigation and the response run fairly smoothly, considering that we didn't have a lot of experience with doing a large-scale investigation for rabies. And run fairly successfully. The first is that we needed to have flexibility in our planning. In the early stages of the planning, we were really unsure of what the exposure was going to be. It could have been, we called up and we talked to the university and found out that, oh, there was, a single bat and it was flying outside the dormitory building and, they were just all very excitable and it wasn't a big deal. Or we could have, found that something had gone on and everybody was, bats were falling down and everybody was picking them and playing toss the bat. You never know what people will do. And it could have ranged, to upwards of 200 people that needed prophylaxis. We knew that our regional office, our regional state office had vaccine inventory on hand, but they didn't have enough on hand for a mass prophylaxis response if we were looking at our worst case scenario. So we were able to work with the central state office and set in motion plans to mobilize additional vaccine inventory from their other regional offices that are located throughout the state to move those in if needed. And ultimately, we didn't need those plans, but everybody felt much more comfortable knowing that those plans were in place. The second thing that really helped was pre-existing relationships between agencies is really going to facilitate a rapid response. Rabies investigations really can involve multiple different agencies. You have your animal control, you have your laboratorians, you have your EPIs, you have all sorts of stuff going on. So we have really worked to build good relationships with our partners, both our internal partners as well as our external partners. What this meant was that when we had to start pulling everybody in for this response, especially given that we didn't know very much what was going on in the beginning, we knew who to call. We knew everybody's names. They knew who we were. We trusted each other. We had worked together on, you know, much smaller events, so we felt comfortable with everybody's skill level and the knowledge that they brought to the table. And again, we knew all the agencies, we knew our strengths, we knew our limitations, and we knew what our standard roles and responsibilities were, so we knew what everybody was going to be comfortable doing and what we were comfortable having them do. And then finally, what I really think was important was focusing on timely and risk communication to reduce the worried well effect. Something like rabies can be a very scary word, you know, scary disease, and so we did have a lot of people that initially were very concerned, am I going to die? You know, that sort of a thing. And we really focused on getting everybody into that initial town hall meeting with the informational briefing and giving them a long opportunity to ask any questions and address their concerns both in that group setting and then in that individual assessment. And I think that our efforts on that really worked out well, and given that we only had one student who didn't meet our exposure categories, who did still elect to receive prophylaxis. So I think that really helped minimize the risk of vaccinating people that weren't really at risk or needing vaccines. And then finally, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors on this presentation. Within our health department, we have Drs. Arafat, Awasiko Lumo, as well as our health authority, Dr. Peirce and Melanie Ramon, who worked with me on our zoonosis team at the time. And secondarily, our partners at the Texas Department of State Health Services Region 65 South office in Houston, Dr. Paul Grunwald, the regional vet, as well as Gary Johnson. Thank you very much. So we have time for a few questions if anybody has anything. In the back. We did. We had a number of discussions about that. And actually, I didn't mention there was one bat that was tested. We ultimately decided not to try and sample the bats because we didn't feel that it would really provide useful information. A negative response on that one bat didn't necessarily mean. The reports was that the colony was about 30 to 40 bats in size. So if we tested a few and some of those came back negative, it didn't mean that there was no risk. Additionally, we also felt it had the chance to raise concerns. We weren't able to tie specific bats to specific students. So just because a bat came back positive didn't mean that which students actually may have had contact with that bat, if any. So we felt that it didn't serve on our end to reassure and had the possibility to inflame, and ultimately decided not to. Now, I did say we did have one bat that was tested. The pest control company that the university contracted with, when they came in and were doing their first sweep, the head of the pest control company actually, there's a lot of media around, and he picked up a bat that he had found and displayed it to the television reporter to sort of talk about what a bat was, and then called us afterward and said, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. So we did test that bat. Ultimately, the result of that bat came back indeterminate. A lot of bat test results do come back indeterminate. The bat brain is very small, about the size of a walnut. And so it can be very difficult to get a good section and to get staining on a test result. So we talked with that agent, the pest control company owner, and he felt very comfortable. He had carefully and gingerly held it by the arms. He had it, or by the wingspan, rather. He didn't have any cuts or abrasions on his hand, and he ultimately decided not to receive prophylaxis and is indeed fine at that point. Any other questions? Yeah, like I said, that's really a concern of ours, and it's a concern anytime you're doing any sort of a large response. We've had other responses for other diseases where you do have a very strong worried well effect, and it is, you know, as someone who is not at risk and is a scientist, it is very challenging to deal with that response, and that was why we really wanted to push forward with that timely risk communication effort. It's in the back. That was something that actually wasn't totally resolved until we were well into the response plan. One of the things that all the agencies felt very strongly about was we didn't want any of the students to not receive treatment because of an inability to pay. But we also knew that we didn't have the time to work all of the details of that situation out and then start a response process. So we all sort of sat around the table and agreed, we will find a way to make this happen for students that needed to make it happen. What ultimately happened was all of the students were required to carry, minimal health care coverage through the university if they didn't have personal health insurance, either through their own or through their parents. That minimal health care coverage, when we checked with that agency, provided money for vaccinations up to a $250 cap. And if you've ever worked with rabies prophylaxis, you know that it can really run into the thousands of dollars. So that only addresses a small portion of it. We had a lot of effort and a lot of paperwork involved with for the students that did have private insurance, getting that in, and we build their, our state partners build their private insurance companies. And ultimately what ended up happening was that the university agreed to pick up any costs that wasn't covered either by their university health care plan or by students' private insurance.
Last question.
We have time for one last question if anyone else has something. No, thank you very much.